I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 17, Stupid O'Clock.
Dear Matt, if you had a webcam pointed at me, and I'm going to assume you don't, you'd see me sitting in my usual place at my desk, the view of my little piece of Southern California sky visible through the window to my right, with Frankie, one of our two labs, asleep on my feet. Frankie's 9 now, and she's gotten wily about ensuring my full attention at all times. What you're doing right now, well, I have no idea. Most likely, given the time difference between England and America, you're asleep. One of the things I like about these exchanges of ours is that they're asynchronous, like the correspondences they're modeled after. Everything's gone instant in the world. Breaking news and hot takes, memes you can blast out worldwide before anybody has a chance to consider whether they're funny or not. There's something to be said for asynchronicity. You send yours to me, I take some time to think, I send mine back to you. That gap allows each of us to think carefully and well about what we want to say. I don't think I'm spilling state secrets if I say that sometimes one or the other of us, okay, yeah, it's almost always me, takes a pretty long time to think before responding. The craft of what we're doing here lies in maintaining the sense, sometimes the illusion, that even if that pausing and considering has taken a while, the exchange is a conversation, and it has some of the feel and the rhythm of a conversation. But man, oh man, sometimes that gap stretches out. It stretches out unreasonably. And then it's time to think about why. Why is this one so hard? So slow? Why this one? I'm also not spilling state secrets if I say that this very thing has just happened to us. Let's look at the calendar, shall we? About 2.5 months ago, I pitched that this episode, number 17, be about focus and attention, and the ways those things get shredded in the course of our daily lives in 2024, and what creative people can do to preserve and protect attention, and why it's important that we do so. This seemed to both of us like a worthwhile thing to look at, so we put it on the schedule. I sent a draft of the first segment to you 9 days later. You sent your reply back in 48 hours, which is very like you, and which frequently makes me want to murder you, especially when what you send back is good, which it almost always is. This time, though, we both felt like it had gone a little wide of the mark, and so you went back in. That took an additional 3 weeks. I got my reply back to you almost 4 weeks later. Then you did a bunch of gigs, and then you went to Italy for a week, easy proximity to Italy being another thing that enrages me about you. And when you got back, we had our usual Zoom call, and you told me you'd been struggling with this one, and so we agreed to drop it. I think we were both pretty relieved, to be honest, because even by the casual standards of the work process we've developed, this one was starting to seem a little ridiculous. There's a thin line between thinking and spinning your wheels, and we'd crossed it some time back. All we needed to do was recognize it and admit it. But that's always a tricky moment, and it's easier said than done. So, in this episode, in this second stab at this episode, we're talking about giving up, and when, in the course of creative work, it's the smart money move. Now, the first thing to say is, it's rarely easy. There's a sunk cost fallacy at work. You've invested a number of brain cycles in something. The last thing you want to do is put it aside, because brain cycles are precious. Time is precious. Effort, too. But ultimately, that's why you need to be a little ruthless about work that doesn't seem to be panning out. In the big scheme of things, putting something aside when it isn't working is about protecting your time to do this work, not about squandering it. I'm not saying it's easy, by the way, to identify work that isn't panning out right while you're in the process of doing it. In my experience, the work itself is so grueling and so difficult that I'm always a little skeptical of the voice that suggests my time might be better spent elsewhere. I mean, I hear that voice a lot, because I'd almost always rather be anywhere else than where I am, if where I am is writing. So let me propose this for starters, and you can tell me if it makes any sense. What time and experience teach you is how to distinguish between an everyday impulse to piss off and go play video games and the rarer, more subtle instinct that tells you you're fishing a dry hole. Do you have trouble telling that difference? Or am I just talking about myself again? I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill, I'm sitting in my comfy chair by the window on a grey-skied, drizzly, incredibly British afternoon, drinking an amazing coffee. Beans from Italy, steamed some milk perfectly, and then I added a dash of maple syrup that my friend Brian makes from scratch in Ottawa. Hi Brian, your maple syrup is amazing. I don't have a dog asleep at my feet, but I do have my cat, Flynn, sitting on the windowsill next to me, staring out of the window, fixing her gaze on anything that dares to move under her watch. I am safe to write this, guarded from the outside by, oh no, she got hungry and went downstairs. I bet people are surprised by how long these things take to write, as revealed in your very special behind-the-scenes segment. But yeah, we tried to make these, good. And if that means admitting when we can't keep focus on an episode that was specifically about focus, well, the irony alone should make us sit up in our chairs and pay attention. As you say, it often feels really difficult to decide to give up on something, especially if you're doing it with someone else. There's all kinds of interrelational convolutions to be navigated, and it's very easy to think that by giving up, you're letting your American co-podcaster down, so you keep trying to make it work, and the more you try, the less it works. What you think is your engine running smoothly is actually the gears heating up until they grind slowly to a halt. And you're right about the more time and work you've put into something, the harder it is to quit. It feels like some kind of gambling addiction. You've sunk too many of your chips into this hand of poker. They're lost either way, but at least realize when to stand up from the table and don't go all in. In my day job, which is in fact a nighttime job, it's not too difficult to tell the difference, to quote the Reverend Stone Cold Steve Austin, between stomping a mud hole and walking it dry. If I have an idea for a gag or a trick or some other piece of lowbrow shtick, and I do it a few times in front of an audience, if they respond somewhere on the scale between indifference and pure hatred, then it's time to ditch it. The huge trunk in my office and the 12 million old suitcases in my attic are testament to this. They're filled with old props that all tell the same story of me having, and this is in bold type, an idea, and then getting the props and spending days, weeks, months, or longer learning how to do a thing, before either realizing myself or with the help of a dark room full of strangers that the idea I had was shit. That should also probably be in bold type. But my side hustle, this, writing, that's so much harder. I mean, maybe it's because I've spent more time earning money from performing than writing, so I have a better sense of what works in that world, but when I write something, I usually know if it's completely hellishly awful, but I don't often know if it's any good. So, perhaps a key part of being an artist is learning the ability to know when the thing you're making sucks. It still feels like a bit of a taboo to admit that kind of failure. As if the mark of an artist is that once they channel the muse, all they can spin is gold. But no, it's more complicated and less magical than that. Creativity is, as we say on this podcast, hard work. And part of learning to do any kind of hard work is knowing when the effort is worthwhile and when it's not. So, is giving up on something the last great creative taboo? Can you really say you're an artist if you haven't spent a long time on something, only to end up dragging it into the trash can on your laptop? Don't judge me as an artist by what I've made. Judge me by the amount of props in the suitcases in my attic. I'll talk to you soon, unless we decide this one isn't working out either. Matt.
Dear Matt, I like that moment where you get all sentimental about how Flynn is protecting you from external threats, scanning the perimeter like a sniper, and suddenly she gets hungry and pisses off downstairs for a snack. This is, in a nutshell, what it means to live with domestic animals. It's like our animals and we are telling two different stories. I once twisted my ankle in our backyard so badly that I plummeted to the ground, immobilized for a moment. And as I laid there gasping in pain, both of our dogs came trotting over with a look in their eyes that said, "This isn't going to affect your ability to feed us, though, right?" We can kid ourselves that what they feel for us is love, but the hard cold truth is we're only there for their convenience. So, sure, while we have a moment before Flynn starts keening to be petted, or Frankie starts feeling starved for amusement, let's talk about abandonment. You and I have both tipped our hats in this episode to the sunk cost fallacy. So let's pause here for a second and look at it a little more closely. The sunk cost fallacy is the belief that one should continue along an unsound course beyond the point at which it's clear that it's unsound, because one has already invested in it. That initial investment is the sunk cost. The fallacy was first defined by an expert in behavioral sciences, Richard Thaler, who proposed that a good or a service is more likely to be used when a subject has had to pay money for it. Now, one of the classic examples of the sunk cost fallacy is what's come to be called the Concord fallacy. And guess what? You guys have a starring role. In the early 60s, the British and French governments, who had separately been working up plans for a supersonic passenger aircraft, decided to join forces. What could possibly go wrong? Well, quite a lot, actually. For one, it quickly became clear that the proposed development costs were laughably inadequate. They eventually ran to more than six times the original projections. But early on, nobody thought to pull the plug. Why? Because by the time they discovered this, they were already in too deep. They were literally throwing good money after bad. There were a number of other problems with Concorde. It never did sell very well to the airlines. It burned fuel like a 64 Caddy, cost a fortune to operate. And the sonic boom it produced annoyed everybody along its flight path. The Concorde, the plane of the future, ended up flying for less than 30 years before being scrapped in the early 2000s. It was the most famous flop in the history of aviation. So, that's the sunk cost fallacy in its classic form. It's easy to see why people, not just governments, but individuals, have an instinct to protect an investment of money and to avoid the negative emotions that go with abandoning that investment, even when logic tells them they should. But how does this apply to creative work? Well, here's where we encounter two psychologists, Catherine Bloomer and Hal Arkus, who, in an imaginative leap, expanded Thaler's theorem beyond money to encompass time and effort. This puts the phenomenon into a much wider frame. You and I, as you've said, work hard on these episodes. There's a lot of brain work involved. I've used this quote before. The historian David McCullough said, "Writing is thinking. To write well is to think clearly. That's why it's so hard." It's about effort. That effort, the quest for clarity, what we've been calling the hard work of creativity. Try this on for size. It's the most precious thing we have to offer. So of course we want to avoid spending it capriciously, because doing so leads inevitably to regret. Regret leads to second-guessing your choices. And man, that's a slippery slope. So, how do we avoid this toboggan ride of regret? I liked what you said about suitcases full of failed tricks in your attic being badges of honor in a way. So let me propose a refinement. If you zoom out on this process of creativity and consider it as an ongoing whole, something interesting happens. It's sort of a paradigm shift. The things we set aside start to look less like failures than inflection points. Every lousy draft, every trick that drew crickets from an audience, these are stops along the way toward something else, something better. The trick is to coax ourselves into seeing creativity as a process, as a path, and ideally a lifelong one. If we can do that, then those abandonments are easier to see as speed bumps and not as failures. and the time we put into them as an investment in ourselves and our talent. It's a reframing. It's good mental health. So, here's to good mental health, huh? Although, just so you don't think I'm too healthy, I sort of envy you having that dark room of strangers to weigh in on your stuff when all I have is the nattering voices in my own head, because can I tell you something? The nattering voices in my head are dicks. They're negative, they're stingy with praise, and they never shut up. But maybe that's my problem. Frankie's looking up at me with the look I like to tell myself is affection, but which I know is probably just gas, so I'm going to... Yeah, it's definitely gas. Time to go. Give my best to Flynn, and I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, I think I knew what the sunk cost fallacy was before I knew what the sunk cost fallacy was, if you see what I mean. And yes, I'm going to talk about my background in street performing again. I'm really sorry. I'm rapidly turning into the grandfather that makes everything about his war stories. So, as a street performer, the sunk cost fallacy, and I think I've said that phrase enough times now, is made very clear to you. You got up at stupid o'clock, got the bus into town when it was still dark, got to the pitch early enough to snag a time slot for your show. Then, you go to breakfast and try and make beans on toast to last as long as you can, and then there's a few more hours standing around behind the pitch being chilly and watching other people do their shows until finally, you warm up, put on your costume, stride out onto the piazza for your turn, and it rains. And depending on your mood and financial situation, you might let the amount of energy, time, and money you've spent to get to this point convince you to keep going, and see if you can be compelling enough to convince a tiny smattering of people to get as wet watching you as you get performing for them, so maybe you'll at least break even. Or you might have a moment of clarity and think to yourself, you know what, screw this, and go home. When I lived in South London, we used to be able to watch Concorde streak into the sky from our garden. It was so beautiful, elegant, like a big graceful swan migrating. It feels like a shame that it no longer exists. It was at the cutting edge of its technology, and it did what it did spectacularly. But then, progress got cock-blocked by capitalism. Can't help but think that if the moon landings had needed to turn a profit, they might not have happened. By the time the Concorde project was cancelled, it was making money. But apparently, the final nail in the coffin was when the brains at British Airways realised if there was no Concorde, then the passengers who used it would instead buy first-class tickets on normal airplanes and actually end up paying more. So, pretty soon after that, there was no more Concorde. But yeah, I think you're right on the money about the problems with the whole sunk cost fallacy idea. Sure, when we're talking about actually sinking money into something, then that's vaguely measurable, but time, effort, thinking, pondering, trying different approaches to a thought, to think of any of these things as having successes or failures is to miss the point of what they're for. We wouldn't have the theme for this episode had we not failed on the first idea. Sometimes the cost is not as sunk as it seems. Sometimes it just pays off in ways you didn't predict. Like you say, it's all speed bumps on the journey, or maybe even junctions. Every creative choice, every choice takes you in a new direction like an ever-spreading multiverse of making. I'm circling the idea that in creativity, the concept of failure, and therefore also of success, is not useful. But that's not quite it. Obviously, if I land a trick rather than dropping it, there is a success versus failure thing happening. That's undeniable. But perhaps what I'm trying to say is that although you have to keep that in the back of your mind, it should be low down on your list of priorities for making things. Check in with it every so often. Stand back, cross your arms, take a look at the thing and consider if it'll do what you want it to do. But in between those coffee breaks, maybe that's not how you should think about creative work. Maybe just have an image in your head of a beautiful, sleek metal swan that can fly faster than sound and see what happens when you try to make one. Oh, and it's adorable that you think I don't have the voices in my head, and that you also think that a room full of clapping, laughing people would silence them. Oh, no, no, no. The voices in my head have a very good line in, "What, you're going to believe strangers over your own thoughts? Don't be stupid. They're clearly wrong. What do they know? Now, you listen to me." Oh, Flynn just came in and walked over toward me. I stupidly thought she was coming to say hello, but then I realised I'd put a plate down, which might still have some butter on it. And now she's staring at a USB cable and considering chewing it enough to start what would be her third house fire. Long story. Talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, this seems to have become an episode about the Concorde as big steely metaphor, which is totally fine with me. I enjoy a good metaphor as much as the next guy, assuming the next guy is a grad student in semiotics. So, let's indulge. Before we do, though, I should add one piece to the historic record. It may well be true that the death blow to Concorde was a matter-of-fact dollars and cents calculation in the C-suites of British Air, but the moment the Concorde died as an idea, as a metaphor for flight, is generally held to be the moment in July 2000, when Air France Flight 4590, Concorde serial number B203, burst into flames and crashed on takeoff from Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, outbound to JFK, killing all 109 people on board. It was a horrific wreck that grounded the entire Concorde fleet for over a year, and eventually, in concert with other factors to be sure, spelled the end of commercial supersonic air travel. So, okay, metaphor. Two things about the way you pivot back to the notion of Concorde as sleek, steely, skyborne swan. One, that's a beautiful piece of writing. You set up the idea as if it's nothing, a throwaway. And then you meander away and talk about some other stuff for a while. And then, with an electric sizzle, you streak back to it at the perfectly apt moment to seal your point. The best example of this I ever saw was in Sam Anderson's 2021 profile, Kevin Durant and Possibly the Greatest Basketball Team of All Time, in the New York Times Magazine. It's my nominee for the best magazine profile ever written. If you haven't read it, do yourself a favor and go look it up right now. And keep an eye out for the thing with the asteroid. And that's all I'll say about it. However, this technique is applicable beyond journalism. John Cleese, you know, tall fella, little mustache, kind of turned into a dick in his later years. Yeah, that's the guy. Cleese once said that on Fawlty Towers, he and Connie Booth always tried to bury what writers call plot points in a joke, which I still think is one of the best concrete pieces of advice I ever heard about the craft of writing comedy. Plot points are the, well, they're the points at which your plot pivots or lays down a marker for some future development. It is, now that I think about it, a staggeringly literal name, so literal that it was probably coined by a development executive, but I pause here to explain it nonetheless. Anyway, what Cleese and Booth strove to do was toss these key bits of story away in the guise of a gag, so you didn't see coming the moment when they'd return or get reprised. That's great writing, and you did it instinctively. I kind of hate you a little bit right now. So that's the first thing about the Concorde swan idea. The second is, it's a particularly good metaphor, I think, because it contains within it all the complexity, all the seeming contradictions, maybe, of that A-B, on-off, success-failure paradigm we struggle with when we think about creative abandonment. Concorde was, by intent, a tool, a commercial instrument, designed and built to move people between distant points quickly. And it did that. But spiraling development costs, lackluster ticket sales, anemic orders from the big airlines, these earthbound things eventually exerted a gravitational pull that Concorde couldn't overcome. But Concorde was also, and this I think was a happy accident, beautiful. In a way, no airliner before had ever been beautiful. Its lines so sleek and graceful that it could make people sitting in their South London backyards, people who probably heard 24 takeoffs a day, stop and look up and think about giant silver swans streaking impossibly through the air, and then remember that feeling decades later. Success and failure. Lift and gravity. Persistence and abandonment. The real scope of a creative process isn't always so clear or so easy to measure. That's why that wide angle is so important to maintain. Because, I'll say it again, creativity is not a moment. It's a path. I've mentioned before that there's a Japanese fine art woodworker, a guy named Ishitani, whose YouTube videos I like to watch. This is a guy who sits up in the mountains of Japan and takes giant hulking slabs of black walnut and turns them into the most delicate, classically beautiful trestle tables and side chairs and cabinets. There's always a moment in the process when he stops what he's doing, scrambles up on a bench, folds his arms, adopts a stillness, and lets his eyes wander over the project in progress. You can see him take it all in, not just the length and breadth and thickness of the slab, but the path the slab is on, from tree to mill, to workshop floor, to home. Is it a little mystical to describe it this way? Maybe. Probably. But it's a perfect illustration of that moment where a creator stops to think about the path between where they've been and where they want to go. Because here's the thing about paths. They don't always go where you think they're going to go. And some creative abandonments are really just pauses. I said a minute ago that the Air France crash spelled the end of commercial supersonic air travel. Well, that isn't quite true. Why did I phrase it that way? Because writing! I wanted the punch of the idea to land cleanly and not hit glancingly, knowing that its effect surely would have been diluted if I qualified the thought by noting that there is, right now, 2 decades later, a new supersonic passenger airliner in development. Boom Technology, an American startup, is well on the way to putting a new supersonic in the air by 2029. They've already received orders from United and American for a plane they're calling Overture. It'll carry 70 passengers 60,000 feet in the sky at almost twice the speed of sound. And it will be beautiful. I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill, the name for the uber elite club of people who have had sex on a Concorde whilst in flight, which reportedly was not easy as it's not the largest of cabins, so everybody else kinda knew. Anyway, the name for that group is, of course, the 11 Mile High Club. I discovered that while researching for this episode. It's not relevant, but I wanted to share. Also, the world's longest golf putt was performed on Concorde. José María Glazabal hit a ball down the center aisle of the plane. The ball rolled for less than 30 seconds, but since Concorde was, at the time, traveling at 1,270 miles an hour, the ball, in that time, had traveled a distance of 9,232 miles. Side note, for those of you with too much time on your hands who might have done the above maths and failed to reach the same conclusion, you'll have to also take into consideration how the altitude of the aircraft acts as a multiplier on the ground distance covered. This is, once again, a podcast about the hard work of creativity, airspeed equations, and Concorde golf records. The astonishing poetry of something big and heavy and made of metal with people inside, moving faster than actual sound. It still, to me, feels like it inhabits the same school of science as the TARDIS. Almost all previous versions of humans, if you could even explain to them that sound travels, would think you are making an argument for witchcraft. It would be as believable as claiming to have a horse that could gallop through time. There are aircraft that still fly that fast, of course, but they're mostly used to launch missiles, fire machine guns, or drop bombs. It just seems sad that the only use of such otherworldly technology is for war. It's not often that I lament the loss of something intended purely for rich people, but there we are. I also like that the reason Concorde was so absolutely beautiful was purely scientific. Those smooth lines, the elegant length, the dipping nose, they all deliver aesthetically, but that's just a byproduct of their function. It needed to look like that to be able to do what it did. Like the opposite of John Cleese, whose increasingly pinched, scowling face can only be the result of the dried pee of angry old man intolerance bouncing around inside his skull ever shrinking. Stupid John Cleese. I'm a middle-aged comedy performer in the UK, so of course as a kid I loved Monty Python and Fawlty Towers, but you're right. As he's aged, he's become so bitter and boring. Such a shame and such a cliché. Maybe he always was, though. His fellow Python, Eric Idle, seems to have no time for him anymore, and tells a story about Cleese proudly saying he'd do anything for money, so Idle gave him £1 and told him to shut up. This isn't supposed to be an episode about Concord or John Cleese, it's supposed to be about the benefits and costs of giving up on something, but damn it, we're artists, and I've been enjoying looking at pictures of planes. But okay, let's tie things up. Let's land this jet. Sorry, I'll try and stay focused. Was Concord, in fact, a failure? They gave up, sure. But how many other types of discontinued passenger jet does everyone remember 20 years later? Those that flew on it talk about how incredible it was and how glamorous and futuristic it felt and how cramped that bathroom was for sex. Those that stood in their back garden and watched it fly over still, I'm told, make forced swan metaphors about it. Judging failure and success is all down to knowing what the goals were at the start, and then being able to assess if those goals were met. And sometimes it is and should be as simple as that, but if you're making something artistic, then that all feels a bit binary. Make something, and then see where it succeeds and where it fails. See who it means what to. See where it leads. See what it inspires. Very little, when viewed this way, fails completely. And you mentioning the Overture supersonic jet project makes that clear. It wouldn't exist had the Concorde not existed, but it also wouldn't exist if the Concorde hadn't failed. Although, why is it called the Overture? It should be called the Encore. I am totally going to send them an email. Next week on Aeronautics and Junk, we'll be discussing the history and legacy of the autogyro. From the Benson gyrocopter to the BGA Hawk 4, and of course we'll be getting deep into the debate between pusher and tractor engine configurations. Or maybe we should just give up on that one. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barol in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barol. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.